This is the story of how a handsome young Canadian man of education and charm found himself. Found himself as a nasty, hard-bitten, dishonest, sarcastic, disreputable old man. A man of Max Ferguson's intelligence might have become anything, perhaps even prime minister. But such was fate that he found himself and finds himself today as a whole stock company of voices doing sketches on the radio.
High in the sky above, the love song of the trees will blend and wend its way out on the breeze. Tall timbers calling and the echoes ring. Moral nature sings a song along the timber trail. The timber trail.
Timber!
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 Well, folks, that's the kind of music we're tossing your way on old Afterbreakers Breakdown, and I hope it ain't too hard to listen to. Good morning.
Good morning, Rawhide. How are you with Grod Body?
Well, I'm fine, thanks. And what's your name?
Don't worry about that, Rawhide. I'm your commercial announcer on the show. I'm the detail of this show, you lucky, lucky fellow, you. And you're probably getting one of the chaps with what I might call the most golden voice in radio, and I'm going to do the commercial on this show.
But just a second now, you don't understand.
There's nothing to understand, Ron. Pardon me, I'll go right into it now. I can hardly wait to tell all the folks listening in. Friends, and especially you ladies listening in, you're in for a treat this morning with this grand program After Breakfast Breakdown, this grand chap, Rawhide. And remember, folks, as you listen to the program, that it's brought to you by the makers of... The makers of... This is most embarrassing. Sorry, Rawhide, I came in so fast, I didn't find... Who was sponsoring the show?
Well, that's the point. It ain't sponsored. It's just sort of a sustaining show. We're just doing it for the fun of the thing.
What? Do you mean to tell me I've been wasting my golden voice on a show that isn't even sponsored?
Well, yeah, I meant to tell you before you come in.
Well, this is I've seen everything now. Wasting a voice like mine on a show that isn't sponsored.
Well, now, just a second. Now, don't get sore. I'm sorry about this. The CBC is giving me 35 cents a week. I could give you 10 cents of that.
I've never been so humiliated. You mean to tell me you've got the unmitigated gall to stand there and tell me that I'm wasting my voice on a show that isn't sponsored? Well, goodbye.
Well, that's kind of tough. I sure offered him 10 cents.
Did you say 10 cents?
Yes, I said 10 cents.
Well, I suppose it's money after all. I might as well take it, but thank you, I'm humiliated.
Oh, gosh, I'm sorry everything like that happened. I should have told him it's just a sustaining program. Well, no use folks is listening. Folks, we're going to move on here with another little tune. It's by Tex Williams and his outfit, and it's a peppy little thing called the Roundup Polka.
Before we talk about Rawhide, the radio personality, can we talk about Max Ferguson? Where were you born, and when did you decide to take up radio work?
I was born in England, Mr. McCulley, lived in Ireland till I was 2 1/2, and my family moved to London, Ontario. I was educated in London, and I majored in English and French at college, a strange training for a chap who ends up doing Rawhide, but for quite some time I had been interested in teaching. I still think it's the most valuable profession in the world and should be the most highly paid.
Hear, hear.
But I guess in my last year of college, when we started to do some local college productions on the local station, that was where I was bitten by the radio bug. In any event, I applied for an audition with the CBC and was given a job in 1946 when I graduated and sent to Halifax as staff announcer with the CBC.
And exactly how did the Rawhide show originate, Max?
Well, when I was sent down as staff announcer in 1946, Mr. McCulley, I did just about everything a staff announcer does, news, record shows. And the first or second week, I discovered that there had been running down here a program of cowboy music, half an hour on Saturday mornings. And I was assigned to this as part of my duties. But I felt a little squeamish. I was perhaps more sensitive in those days, and I had made a few friends down here. And perhaps boasted a little that I was with the CBC, and I didn't want them realizing that I was doing cowboy music. So, just in the space of about 10 seconds or so, I decided to disguise my voice, and I dropped it down to about here and stuck my jaw out and slopped my way through the program insulting all the cowboy artists and finished the show thinking I would never have to do such a thing again, but the program director had heard it and decided that he'd do this as a program 6 days a week to the Maritime Network.
But then you moved to Toronto, didn't you?
Yes, that came after about 2 years down here, early in 49. I was still employed as a staff announcer doing Rawhide just as a hobby down here. And as staff announcer, I had my application in, as all of us did, to eventually get someday to the pulse of Canadian radio, Toronto. And I believe it was Larry Henderson who left the CBC about that time. And I was sent up to replace Larry as staff announcer. But at that time, the very first article that was done on my program came out in the Montreal Standard. I presume it was read by some CBC official because I think it was about the same day as it hit the newsstands, I was asked to do Rawhide to the Eastern Network, as they call it, from Ontario down to the Maritimes.
Well, Max, can we hear some of the Rawhide characters right now?
Well, there's my announcer-producer, Marvel Mellowbell, who displays certain qualities such as amyloids, insincerity, and a slight bit of pomposity, Mr. McCulley. I also have the only Canadian accent. It's a burlesque of an accent heard in the Ottawa Valley.
And this fella's kind of truty, you know, but he's got a lot of dramatic know-how and takes the leading roles in all them dear plays, you see.
And I've got a rural character who drops in. Snuffy, he don't care much for world politics, long as Frost don't get the pumpkins out there on North 40. And then, of course, there's a hodgepodge of characters. I've got a bit of a cockney voice I'll bring in now and again.
I've got Sir Cedric Fitz Bumblebee, of course, much more dignified type of English accent. And now and again, we bring in this voice that might pass as, say, maybe a Cork accent, Mr. McCulley. And of course, if you're going to go up to the north of Ireland, you got to get a different kind of a voice. If it calls back on the throat up there, Mr. McCulley, a fellow from Belfast might speak about like that. They call it the Ulster accent, you see, Mr. And I have a couple of women's voices. We have a poetess from Victoria, B.C.
Elizabeth Barrett Blueing, Mr. McCulley, very gushy and very, very arty.
And then a more raspy women's voice. She's my women's commentator. And all the ladies in Toronto who do the same type of thing, they all think I'm making fun of them. But I'm not. I don't think I am, anyway.
And the voices go on like that. And, of course, the only... Well, I use a few well-known voices who actually exist. Perhaps the best known is...
Mr. James Vanillen, who is quite often heard introducing sparkling programs on CBC Wednesday night.
Very good, Max.
Okay, Rawhide. Now, take it easy, kid. You're on the air in 20 seconds.
Gosh, my knees is knocking so hard, I can hardly hear myself thinking.
Relax, pal, relax. Listen, kid, with me as your manager, you can't miss. I've been in show business for years. Now, I tell you, there's nothing wrong with it. Don't worry about it. Now, look, you just open with a couple of red-hot punchlines, like, why did a chicken cross the road? And then you make a funny face, see, for the benefit of them what's got television sets.
Yeah, but I don't know how these here Ontario listeners is going to take to this kind of stuff.
Listen, kid, corn is corn no matter where you are. In the Maritimes or in Ontario. Kid, they'll love it. Ain't I always played right by you? Ain't I always given you a good steer since I was your manager? Didn't I treat you right the very first time we met you in Toronto last week? Who else would sell you the Royal York for $2? Well, listen, you can't go wrong. Look, you're on here in about 5 seconds. Here, put a little more rosin on your tonsils. Got your rubber mouthpiece in there, okay? Now, look, kid, you're on here in 5 seconds. Take it easy. 4, 3, 2, 1. Take it away, kid, you're on the air.
Good morning, folks. This is your old pal, Rawhide. Now, it's grand to be speaking to the folks in the Maritimes, but you folks in Ontario and the new listeners this morning probably don't know old Rawhide. But I got here a little show that I think you might enjoy. It's something like a program that's already on the air, this musical yours. The only difference is they bring you the music of your choice. I bring you the music you probably can't stand listening to. But the show's kind of like eating olives. You got to swallow a few of them before you get to like it. And then it sort of grows on you like old moss. So much for the apologies at the beginning. Let's roll the theme, boys, and we're away with After Breakfast Breakdown.
Well, I can tell you the exact date of that show then. Obviously, it was the first one to the new audience in Ontario and Quebec. That would be Valentine's Day, 1949. I later was to call it the Valentine's Day Massacre because the roof fell in the next day.
Is that what led you... That was your entree into the House of Commons, was it, Max? Or...
Well, the House of Commons, a minister in Ottawa, wrote to the paper and said it could only happen in godless Soviet Russia. People are just stunned by it, as I am now. I'd be the first to write in if I'd heard this back in those days. But I thought, well, I finished the show and left, came in the next morning, go into the newsroom. I went to the newsroom and saw the teletype machine pounding out the fact that Max Ferguson, who does a program on CBC in the guise of old Rawhide, came in for a severe tongue-lashing in the House of Commons when Dirkless Gooderham Ross of the St. Paul's riding asked the speaker, "Are you aware of this program of meaningless ravings and tripe disguised in the poorest possible English?" And that was it. I did the show, but I went home and a young family starting on the way, and I was wondering where I'd get a job. I used to stevedore anyway on the weekends to eke out my CBC's announced salary. But that's what started the whole thing. There was no preparation for it. They had this program on for years, Musical March Past. And one of the letters that came in, a lot of complaints came in, was from a major, retired Army major in Ottawa, who cut his face because for years he shaved to the rhythms of the Musical March Past, Le Régiment de Sambre et Meuse. Dum, dum, da dum, da dum, da dum. Nice for shaving. And suddenly this clarinet polka came on and he lacerated his face rather badly.
I'd love to imagine that.
Yeah.
But is this how you and the CBC parted company for a
while? Oh, no. They let me get away with things for quite a while. I was the announcer. That's why I was brought to Toronto. I didn't know a thing about the masking for this program until I got here. And they said, "By the way, we understand you've been doing this show to the Maritimes. Would you like to do it here?" And I said, "Yeah, fine. It was fun to do in those days. A little balance to the straight-laced work of announcing." So I did it for 49 to 1954. And that spring, we always had every spring, as the flowers came up and the butterflies appeared, the annual increment. We called it the annual excrement, I must admit. They were a bad-mouthed bunch, the announcers. So we all filed in, 15 of the announcers. I'd never seen them all together before. Bing Whittaker, Elwood Glover, Alan McPhee, and all the big names. And got their little slip of paper, bumping them up, $120 a year. I was at the end of the line, and I stepped up like Oliver Twist and had my hand out, and the chap looked up and said, No, you don't get a raise. And I said, "Why not?" Because I'd been doing this Rawhide show, handing it over free day in, day out, at 5 days a week all these years. And the answer was, "Well, you're at the top of the group, 6. I said, "Yeah, but the rest of them are in 7. Some of them are up halfway up group 8. And I said, "How long will I dangle at this pinnacle of wealth that I'm at now?" And he said, "When something special happens." So I went home. I was really mad. Went home. I wasn't in the house very long before my time slot came up. I think it was 6:30 or something. So morbidly, I turned the radio on, and there was Earl Cameron. And he put on a half-waxed cowboy accent and said, "Well, apparently old Rawhide has moseyed off down the corral." On came the first piece of music that they were filling with, and the phone rang, and this... Gotta watch myself here as I think of adjectives. This chap, I could have been lying on the floor with a heart attack, run over by a CBC mobile unit, but he didn't. He just jumped right in and said, and he swore too before I did. He said, Where do you think you get off not doing your show? You owe the CBC. And when he came up with that line, "You owe the CBC," I always get this warning sensation. I have a good control of my temper, but it gets a bit wild when I lose it. And the warning signal is a prickly sensation that comes up my arms. And I stopped him in the middle of that line. "You owe the CBC." I owe the CBC nothing. I've given them this program 5 days a week ever since 1949. I said, "I'm the lowest paid announcer on staff. You take the CBC with that program and yourself." And I made
where the sun doesn't shine.
I made a suggestion where he could put them. So the next day I came in to resign, but his letter had crossed a little before mine. So I think today I have to face the fact that I was fired. I used to like to think that I resigned, but there's a difference in 5 minutes of the two letters crossing senior management's desk. So. But it turned out to be fine. My one great ally then, the only management type I had too much use for. In those days, they're great now, great Sheila, but way back then, Harry Boyle, he looked like a farmer with his rumpled shirt, and he used to bring his lunch in a brown paper bag. He called me in. I was leaving forever. He said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I don't know what I'm going to do." And then he said, "Why don't you sell them the Rawhide Show and go freelance?" And I said, "Oh, Harry, there's no way they'd buy this. I'm in their bad books." He said, "Go home, take 3 days off, and leave it with me." And at the end of the 3 days, he called to tell me that in order to save the original $120, a raise, they had to now replace me as an announcer and pay at least a similar salary. Plus, my freelance contract was four times what they were paying me to do the announcing. So I was off to Halifax like a shot, and I originated the program from Halifax for a few more years.
I think there's a gorgeous irony in that when you listen to a sketch like this one.
Okay, Dr. Lugosi, I got the neck all swabbed here with antiseptic. The fuse will be good enough to bring the head over here. With you, we can start sewing her on right here.
Oh, nurse, I think I'm going to faint. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to excuse me. I've never seen anything quite like this before in my life.
Well, just mind keeping quiet. We gotta concentrate here. Thanks to interruptions such as this, we've already sewed this head on backwards twice.
I'm sorry, Doctor. It's just that I know that man lying there. He's James Bannerman of the CBC. And that head, it belongs to Ma Perkins.
If there's anything I hate, Dr. Lugosi, it's name dropping.
Yes, it's enough to turn one's stomach. Thank goodness medicine tolerates no social distinctions.
Nah, this guy's Bannerman, Ma Perkins, Nathan Corn, they may be big shots in radio and TV, but when we get them in the lab, huh? There's just so many heads, boy.
May I ask what devilish scheme this is?
Listen, Buster, this here research project was commissioned. Dr. Lugosi, would you put Ma's tongue back here? It's lolling out of her mouth. Yeah, that's better. Put it back in there. This was commissioned by the CBC.
By the CBC? I don't understand.
Well, sure, they read one of these stories about them Russian doctors sewing the head of one dog onto another dog. Well, there's no flies in them CBC people, let me tell you. They know a good thing when they see it. With an operation like this, it opens up all kinds of possibilities. They can get more work out of half the number of actors. John Dreeney and Alan King, they're going to have the same head on the one body. And Ruth Springford and Barry Morris, the two heads on the one body. But the beauty of it is, apparently the CBC has checked this with the Actors Union. They only have to pay the two-headed actor one check. Cuts costs in half. Brings color television that much closer.
Max Ferguson, not your first nor your last punch at the CBC.
No, I remember that skit. That skit brought in a huge complaint from the Toronto General Hospital because that's where we had wonderful sound effects. It was so realistic. And they got in touch with the regional director, Captain W.E.S. Briggs, who called me, and what are you going to do about this, Ferguson? He said, they want an apology, and I want you to give it tomorrow morning on your program. So I came in as Rawhide and mentioned that I'd apparently offended the Toronto General Hospital. And I said, it was just a slight mistake. The operation was to have taken place at Quang Lee's hand laundry farther down University Avenue, and somehow Toronto General slipped out of my mouth before I knew it. But and then I added that I certainly had great respect for the Toronto General Hospital, and if I'm ever having another baby, I'll certainly have it there. Bumped into Ted Briggs, the regional director. Well, did you give the apology, Ferguson? And I said, yes, I did. Splendid, he said, and nothing more was said.
Max, you're a terrier, Max. You know that? I think that may be the greatest compliment I can give you.
Airedale?
Well, maybe a schnauzer.
Our Prime Minister, Pierre-Éliott Trudeau, arrived in London, England last Saturday for trade talks with the British Prime Minister. As a matter of fact, he spent a delightful weekend out at Chequers, the country estate of British Prime Ministers. And today, as part of his itinerary, Prime Minister Trudeau will have a private audience and luncheon with Her Majesty the Queen at Buckingham Palace. Certainly is a delightful treat to enjoy piping hot, strong British tea again. I think that will be ample. It's funny how it always smarts when it overflows the cup and splashes onto one's wrist. That will suffice nicely, thank you. Oh, it's delightful also to see good, strong, rich Devon cream in one's tea. It's something that we don't enjoy in Canada. Is it delivered daily to the palace? I had a very good chat with Mr. Heath at his home over the weekend out in the country. He was asking me how I like checkers, and I told him it was delightful, but I think I prefer chess. I was making a play on the word. The
was very sorry to read about His Royal Highness, the little accident there during the polo game last week when he rode his pony into the goalpost. I suppose you'd call that a filibuster. There again, I was making a play on them. Well, this breast of pheasant is one of the most delectable meals I think I've ever eaten. That would have been shot, I presume, on the grounds of either Balmoral or Sandringham. I love Welsh Corgis. They're a beautiful little dog, aren't they? They're so nicely behaved, so gentle. You wouldn't even realize he was lying here under the table, would you? Until one moves one's feet. Oh, my goodness gracious, I wasn't even watching the time. It's almost 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I've taken up almost 3 hours of your time, which is unforgivable. I really should be pushing off. I have to see Mr. Heath again, and... Can I help you with the dish? Well, once again, thank you ever so much. I really appreciated the lovely tea and the breast of pheasant. That has got to be... That has got to be the longest 3 hours of my life.
Mr. Prime Minister!
Yes?
How did it go in there? How did it go? How'd you make out?
Well, let me tell you one thing. If any of my advisors back in Ottawa ever again dare to suggest taking the Royal out of Royal Canadian Mounted Police, I will personally see that their heads are mounted on the gateposts of 24 Sussex Drive.
Max says Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And did you ever meet Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Max?
Yes, I did meet. I had put off going down to get the Order of Canada. I'd missed all kinds of investitures about 3 years late. And they kept saying, when are you going to pick this thing up? So I went down determined I was not going to succumb to the tyranny of protocol because you're supposed to wear a tux. I put on a suit, and I think I had a rather respectable turtleneck sweater on. Went through the whole ceremony, got my Order of Canada, came out, and there's a little string quartet playing in the foyer outside, and people are milling about. And I was chatting with one of our former CBC presidents, A. Davison Dunton, and I heard this voice behind me saying, what kind of a boor would come to an event like this wearing a business suit? And I turned slowly around, and I just feel my stomach walls contracting and my fists and the prickly sensation up the arm. And there I was, ready to explode, and he had this little Mona Lisa smile on his face and was wearing the most rumpled. It was like the material that army uniforms are made of, just all wrinkled. And this was the joke, that he came as even more of a bore than I did. So, but I told him, I remember saying, what am I going to do with all these stomach acids that have exuded because of that little joke of yours? But it was we had a pleasant chat after that.
Well, the headline we look at today on this Monday, January 28th, is Trudeau leaves for a week of skiing and a meeting with the Club of Rome. The story tells us that the Prime Minister left Ottawa last night on an Armed Forces service flight for a week of skiing in Switzerland, then on to Austria to attend a meeting of a club described as the Club of Rome. It's supposed to be a high-level study group. The story ends with a sentence, there was no indication when the Prime Minister would return home.
Mr. Speaker, it is now 3 weeks since this House reconvened, and still no sign of the Prime Minister. We're told that he is attending meetings of the Club of Rome. What do we know, Mr. Speaker, of this so-called Club of Rome? Some years ago, I unwittingly attended a moving picture called La Dolce Vita under the mistaken belief that this was a documentary on maritime seaweed. Now, this Dolce Vita has left me with trauma to this very day, Mr. Speaker, and I would hate to think that any Prime Minister of Canada is over there mixing it up with such a depraved bunch as I saw in that moving picture, La Dolce Vita. I challenge and defy the Minister of External Affairs to tell us what he knows of this so-called Club of Rome.
Mr. Speaker, it's simply a high-level study group, this Club of Rome.
I wouldn't be surprised, Mr. Speaker, if Trudeau, at this very moment, was lying nude in some milk bath over there, having his back scrubbed by two totally naked and lascivious female Nubian slaves.
Mr. Speaker, the Club of Rome is simply a high-level study group.
Or dancing. Dancing, Mr. Speaker, naked through the streets of Rome. Prancing about by moonlight in the fountains over there. Such as I saw in that shocking La Dolce Vita.
The Club of Rome, Mr. Speaker, is a high-level...
Or, Mr. Speaker, having grapes dropped into his sensuous mouth by wanton female hands while he watches decent Christian folk torn asunder by lions.
Mr. Speaker, the Club of Rome really is known...
Mr. Speaker, I would like to challenge the Minister of External Affairs to tell us what he himself knows and his personal experience with this depraved Club of Rome. In short, I would like to ask him how are things in Sodom and Glockamora.
Mr. Speaker, really, the Club
you
of Rome...
You don't see Mr. Sanfield running off for these
top-level
Club of Rome meetings, Mr. Speaker.
Study group.
And I can assure you that old Sir Johnny...
Always start with a military starter, Max.
You got a problem with that, Sheila?
Well, if I did, I would hardly admit it.
You didn't say that scoldingly. You mean you're just inquiring?
It was an attempt at
originally,
scold.
Originally, Sheila, a selfish motive. I'd love marches to get the sludge moving along through the veins and arteries. But in the intervening years, a lot of letters have come in, starting off with, we love that opening march. And the kids, apparently, like to march around the breakfast table.
Right now, we're going to go to the music library that only you know, that only you see, and you'll play us one of your favorites.
Not just one of my favorites, but I think perhaps the most inquired about piece of music I've ever played. An awful lot of people wanted to get this. It goes back into the early 80s, I think. An annual musical convention held way up in the tip of the Brittany Peninsula. And it is called, at a place called Lorient. It is called the Lorient Festival. And all the Celtic-speaking areas, and there are, I think, about six of them, because there's a little one down in Spain called Galicia, they all send their musicians there. Ireland sent this wonderful singer, and she sings at the very end. It's now been put out as a CD. It's the very last item on the CD, and it was the last closing item of the live concert. It has an old Scottish Gaelic prayer as its text. It's a hymn to the sun. In other words, they hope that they're going to be alive in the morning. The singer, incidentally, most important part of all, lovely voice, an Irish girl, Rita Connolly. And the song is entitled A Gullion.
Thank you.
one of Max's and many listeners' favorites, too, indeed. Gria. This is music that's always meant a lot to you, hasn't it, Max? This kind of music.
Yeah, there's something, I guess, in the blood, as you say. And my first 3 years were spent in Ireland. I can remember two vivid memories of Ireland, but I think something genetic rather than coming back through my own memory, but there's something planted in my genes that makes me partial to not just the music, but when you go over to Ireland and you just fall in love with the country, and you can stop and talk to anybody and you're killing yourself laughing. They have a great, great sense of humor.
I feel that way about the east coast of Canada. I haven't been to Ireland yet, as you know. You could spank me for that, because I've got roots there myself. Or to Scotland, just a wee touchdown in Glasgow. But that's true about Newfoundland. It's true about Cape Breton as well. And Cape Breton was, well, someplace you once retired to in one of your many retirements, right?
Yes, one of my embarrassing moments. I was, my Walden Pond, goodbye, proud world.
Your walk in the snow?
Yeah.
This is how you explained it to your loyal listeners.
30 years of doing 5 shows a week, and I added up, it's going to be close to 10,000 skits that I have done since 1946. And it gets to you after a while. It's like, the closest analogy is the level of fluid or liquid in a barrel. It's about there now. Maybe get one more year out of it. And then there'll be a sucking sound of the old pump. And by that time, I'll be off to keep breath.
Once again, CBC Radio brings you the Max Ferguson Show. And now, finally, here's Max.
Al.
What?
For the first time in 30 years, I've dried up. I've got nothing to say. Take it, Al.
Steady, old man. You can do better than that. As I always say before the program starts, what are you going to say, Max? What are you going to say? You always come up with something. Never have I known you not to come up with something.
What?
And now, here's Max.
What indeed can I say?
I don't know. It's your program. Say what is in your heart. You're glad to leave. You're sorry to leave. All Canada will miss me.
It is a bittersweet day, indeed.
Yes.
A bittersweet day. Because I think with all the publicity about my demise, I probably managed to give the impression that I just can't wait to shake the dust off the old CBC. But somehow...
That really is true.
After 30 years in the old corporation, you just can't write it off overnight. Indeed, there will be memories, most of them happy ones, that I'll take with me to Cape Breton.
Max, I'll say, what are you going to say, Max? What are you going to say? But here's someone that wants to say something to you.
Max Ferguson has always been one of my top favorites. He has a wonderful philosophy of life. His kindness and compassion shone through in all his caricatures of those that he honored. For after all, he had one infinite capacity. He could caricature one, but never did he say anything that was hurtful. We could laugh at ourselves in being the subject of his programs. I know I shall miss him very greatly. However, Cape Breton's a wonderful place for a wonderful man, and all of us who know him well will wish him happiness and good health. The very best to Max Ferguson.
I've never heard you do Mr. Diefenbaker better.
Hello. This is not Max Ferguson speaking. I'm calling to complain that Max Ferguson, I think, really prevented me from becoming Prime Minister of this country as a result of his lousy imitations of me. But I would like to pay tribute to a man who has had a very profound effect on Canadian culture, nevertheless. Because not only has he persuaded Central and Western Canadians to call Maritimers Maritimers, but he's persuaded Maritimers to call themselves Maritimers. Even more important, he said Canadians laughing at themselves. And it is a good sense to retire to Cape Breton. I hope this is only the first of many retirements by Max Ferguson.
Well,
Well, it seems appropriate to follow that Cape Breton song with my farewells. Difficult task after 30 years. I can only say a sincere thanks to all those who have listened, who have written over the years, and have given me more recognition, I think, than any Canadian performer would have a right to expect. And a thanks to all those over the years who have helped me with the show, in particular our present setup. Keith Duncan, who has been producing, Dermot Kenny, at the controls of the mighty organ, and old Blackie McPhee.
Old Al.
For your cooperation, great rapport, and a million laughs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
Thank you. Wow. And welcome to you, too. And some of our guests on tonight's edition of 90 Minutes Live, the wonderful duo, dynamic, I just called them about 15 minutes ago, of Max Ferguson and Alan McPhee. Would you welcome, please, Max Ferguson? Welcome home.
May I ask a favor?
Yes, sir.
I haven't heard a human voice since June, so could you... Anything loud startles me. I'm alone in the woods, as you say, in the highlands of Cape Breton.
Do you want me to speak softly?
I hear Airedales barking and seagulls crying, but human voices are still strange when I suddenly hear them. The English tongue has a strange effect on me when I hear it after all these months.
Neal's Harbor?
Neal's Harbor.
I'm trying to speak softly.
The finest spot in the Marin.
Tell me about your life in... I don't believe you can retire in the first place.
I just heard from McPhee that everybody in Toronto is still saying, well, how long do you think you'll last, type of thing. Every day gets better. They said, oh, well, yeah, the summer and the autumn. Wait till the winter comes. The winter is just great. I'm enjoying every moment of the days fly by. I have no watch. A dog ran away with it on the beach this summer, so I have no watch. I have no television. I'm sorry, no television. I don't bother with newspapers. I do have radio. It's a companion in the evening. But it's a great life.
What's a typical day like? What time do you get up, or do you know?
It's very, very undramatic, because I get up at 6 o'clock with the two dogs, feed them, get them outside, and they take off into the woods. I then go out and chop wood from 8 in the morning till 4 every day, because I have no other... I had no supply of wood. I used it up. I cut it all summer, thinking it would last me all winter, and I burned it all by the middle of October. And since then, I've been out every day cutting wood, burning it that night, because it's spruce, soft wood, and going out the next day. It's been like a treadmill. I take time off to eat one meal a day in the evening. That's true. I'm not exaggerating.
Are you trying to get sympathy?
Well, if anybody wants to chop wood, how would you like to spend a nice holiday chopping wood in the highlands of Cape Breton?
How many times did Alan McPhee introduce you on CBC Radio over the years you worked together?
Into the thousands, I suppose. Never got it right once, but he did several thousand.
Do you want to introduce him now? Do you want to get back?
That would be a nice
switch. Have you ever had a good shot at him?
Well, as a matter of fact, Peter, I have been written to by so many little ladies across Canada who think that I was terrible to Alan, including my own mother. She said, you really are awful to that man.
That's right.
And I tried to tell him that it was all just sort of put on. So I would appreciate the chance to really, sincerely, for all the times I have needled Alan in good-naturedly, but I would like to be able to say that your next guest is a man who has helped me through a good many bad mornings. When I came in a bad mood, he was in such a much fouler mood that it made me feel up. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Arnold McKee.
Alan McPhee.
He was resentful in that introduction. Did you notice? It was so quiet and constrained. I'm so used to saying, and now here's Max, with a great big smile.
That's great material. Did you ever think of making that into a suit?
Oh, that's so old.
That is old.
That is old.
Had that done to me in high school.
You send him to... Dear.
I'm sorry, ask him some tricky, tough
questions. All I've heard is this terrible masculinity going on up in the woods, Al. Boy, up there, and so on. No, he's done very well, because I didn't think he'd last a week, did you?
No. I mean, I don't know him as well as you do.
No, I know you don't. You didn't see him every morning like I did. Every single morning. Oh, I tell you.
So, Max, what happened that made you leave that woodpile in Cape Breton and come back to us?
Just a premature... It was very isolated. I wasn't even in the village of Neal's Harbor. They were down below, and I had this lovely view of the ocean over top of the woods and everything. But I'd come out on snowshoes, and it was a terribly late spring, and I think what finally broke my heart, about middle of May, I was thinking, well, up in Ontario, I'd probably be... My garden would be all in, so I went down to the post office to see if there's any mail, and a couple of the fishermen were standing there. I said, does this winter ever end? There's a blizzard blowing. Oh, yeah. He said, we just seen two or three Mayflowers out there. And my heart leapt up, and I said, where? Right straight out there. And they pointed out into the Atlantic, and here are the ice pans. That's what they call them in the spring, these big round blobs of ice floating in. And I thought, that's a cruel joke. So I don't know. I decided I'd go down there and visit in the summertime and spend my winters up here. That was a failed mission.
And you came back to radio, and you came back with a weekly music program.
Did I?
I think you did.
Thanks for reminding me.
You're welcome.
It's
I think
a,
sometimes
it's all a blur.
I even assume Alan McPhee's role for him. But how many years has that been? Was there a little break in there?
Yes, there was a break in there when I came back from Cape Breton. I heard my name was Mudd because when I left for Cape Breton, I did a rather rash interview with McLean's magazine, which made. Bring back, at least to be apropos.
Fairly recent memories, indeed.
I didn't mention the CBC president, though. The chap I've always called Buona. I was in limbo for quite a while, but I enjoyed it because I wrote about five different plays for the CBC. A brand new venture, and I thoroughly enjoyed doing it.
Max, once you came back, it seems to me you were doing the world music thing long before the rest of the world realized what cachet it had. What got you interested in music from away, far away?
I don't know. I've always been interested in languages. I love hearing, even though I don't understand a word, I love hearing somebody speaking in Spanish. It's one of the most musical of all languages. I love to listen to Scottish Gaelic. And I guess maybe it was just a spillover from the spoken word to the music of these countries. It's the novelty of hearing something that you don't hear every day over the radio here. The drums of Burundi, of course, are a wonderful example of that. It still sends little goosebumps up the back of my neck or wherever you get goosebumps, I guess that's where you get
them. We've got the prickle up your arm and the goosebumps up your neck, and I think maybe we just better stop right there. Barbara Frum was one of many people who interviewed you when you retired, and she called you a quirky musicologist.
That's probably quite accurate.
Yeah? Well, probably only a quirky musicologist would find and play this.
Isabel makes love upon national monuments with style and enthusiasm and anyone at all. Isabel's done Stonehenge and the Houses of Parliament, but so far little Isabel's never played the Albert Hall. Many a monolith has seen Isabel, her bright hair in turmoil, her breast surging swell. But unhappy Albert, so far denied the bright sight of Isabel getting into her stride. The Forth Bridge, the Cenotaph, Balmoral and Wembley, the British Museum and the House of Lords. So many ticks in her National Trust catalogue, but so far the Royal Albert Hall has not scored. Countless cathedrals can now proudly show where Isabel's white shoulder blades have briefly reposed. Miserable Albert, still waiting for the imprint of Isabel on his parquet floor. In Westminster Abbey, she lay upon a cold tombstone, the meat in a sandwich of monumental love, with old pole-faced Wordsworth unblinking beneath, and a bright-eyed young archdeacon breathless above. Many a stony-faced statue has flickered its eyes and swayed to the rhythm of her little panting cries. But oh, wretched Albert never yet has known Isabel's pretty whinnying echo round his dome. On the last night of the promenade, she waved to the conductor, and there and then on the podium, with scarcely a pause, with a smile and a bow and a loud "Rule Britannia," he completed her collection to enormous applause. Rapturous Albert now knows full well he's captured forever elusive Isabel. Prettily disheveled but firmly installed and faithful forevermore to the Royal Albert Hall. No more frantic scramblings up the dome of St. Paul's, no more dank rambles on Hadrian's Wall. With style and enthusiasm and anyone at all, Isabel makes love in the Royal Albert Hall.
Well, that's Jake Thackeray, a man I'd love to meet. Professional rugger player and quite a man with a bottle, but wonderfully
witty. Maybe there's some hints of that in the song. The
lovely
song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's Rabelaisian, this guy, but very funny. And that song, the reason I play it as frequently as I do is because people are always wanting, and you can't get the LP anymore, of course.
Well, you've certainly had a lot of fun on the radio with language. That song is a perfectly good example of how much you love it and how much fun you can have with it. And you've helped uphold the high standard that the CBC used to be known for. Here's a case in point.
Our thought for the day, or rather our headline for the day, comes in from Calgary, Alberta. Provincial Judge L.A. Justison. Nice name for a judge. L.A. Justison, he apparently is a stickler for proper English usage. And he issued a warning yesterday in Calgary court to constables who, quote, dangle their participles in court when giving testimony. And he said he's thinking of throwing out cases if constables don't improve their use of the English language. It should make a bit of difference in the testimony given by constables out there in Alberta courts.
Order in the court! Order in the court! Would the witness for the prosecution kindly take the stand, please?
Well, Constable, I was just glancing down my notes here. I see the vagrancy case we're trying on this occasion is about 7 years old. The charges were laid almost 7 years ago.
Your Honor, that is correct, sir. I asked for some postponements here and there.
Yes, I was noticing, Constable, you've asked for a total of 37 postponements in this case in order to, quote, prepare my testimony.
Well, I wanted to do a good job, Your Worship, and I took a few night classes in English literature, and I read a lot of good books that I think improved my awareness of this musical instrument, which is the English language. Like, I read Bartlett's quotations. I'd never even heard of that before.
Yes, well, let's get on with it. Let's get on with it, Constable. I have quite a docket lined up today. Could you just recall the incident in question on this particular date?
Well, yes, Your Honor. Well, on the morning in question, I was walking along the downtown street in Calgary, and... Well, you might say I was wandering lonely as a cloud that floats on high or veiling hills.
When all at once you saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils.
No, I saw a vagrant.
Oh, all right, well, let's get to the point then.
Yeah, this elderly chap was slouching against the wall of a bank. He was loitering there, and I spotted him as a vagrant, and I interrogated him and tried to ascertain the reason for his being there.
Could we get away from generalities and get the specific words you spoke to the accused on that occasion, Constable?
Yes, Your Honor. I said to him, "Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering?"
You said that to a vagrant?
Yes, I did.
And what did he say to you?
Well, as I recall, he said, "By thy long gray beard and glittering eye, now wherefore stoppest thou me?"
But you haven't got a long gray beard and a glittering eye. Why would a vagrant say that to you?
I don't know, Your Honor, but he did.
All right, continue.
Well, I decided to put the pinch on him.
To put the pinch on him? In what way? What was said? Please, this is all pertinent to the case.
Oh, I looked him in the eye, and I said, "Jack Hughes."
Jack what?
Jack Hughes.
Where on earth would you have picked that up?
I was Emil Zola, some guy said. I kind of, you know, I thought it gave a little tone to the pinch, so I said, "Jack Hughes."
And what did the vagrant say in return?
Oh, he, you know, gave me a little bit of lip, got a little mouthy. These guys don't, you know, you can't frighten them about prison sentences because they're long-time offenders, and he just gave me a little lip.
In what words did he express his feelings?
Well, like he said, as I recall, "Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage." And he gave me one in the groin at the same time.
I see. Well, and then you said what?
Well, I gave him a little friendly lecture about, you know, straightening himself up, trying to get a job, make something out of himself.
What exactly did you say, Constable?
Well, I said to him, you know, just sort of the general routine that we're taught to. Like a man's ambition, I said, should exceed his grasp. Well, what's a heaven for? He gave me another knee in the groin then.
Constable, I think you may have read somewhere that I am a stickler for English usage. I would like to retract those statements I made in public. I would like to go back to the old-fashioned testimony where we get to the point. I've got about 100 cases here to be heard today, so could you please just say what you have to say in your own inimitable way, dangle your participles, let your plural verbs go with singular subjects, whatever you feel at home with, but let's get on with it.
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Now, please, just tell me exactly what you remember.
Like what I remember?
What you remember.
I remember the house where I was born.
Oh, my God.
The little
goodness
window where the sun came peeping in at morn.
Constable, I have a...
He never came a wink too soon, nor brought too long a day.
Constable, could
but
we...
Now, I often wish the night had borne my breath away.
Well, that makes two of us anyway.
I remember the fir trees dark.
Constable,
and high.
You're wasting your time.
I used to think
because I am not only throwing out this case, I'm resigning from the bench. I'm leaving Calgary.
Years and a Day with Max Ferguson was produced by Tim Neeson, Denise Grison, and Donna Cressman-Dubois with Sweeney at the technical controls. Special thanks to Keith Hart and CBC Radio Archives and Roy Harris and Brian Patty and Visual Resources. Max, my most special and deeply felt thanks go to you for 50 years of wonderful and spontaneous radio. You are a delight.
Oh, Sheila, thank you so much, and to Peter coming in there. You know what he is, really?
I don't even know if
he's
I
a likeable,
want to know.
He's a likable son of a gun.
Well, son of a buona, perhaps.
Son of
you,
a buona,
you might
yes.
say. Okay, well, Max, thank you.
Thank you all.
I'm Sheila Rogers. Bye-bye.